Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, our finance sectors are overcharging, undertaxed, and they're a drag on our economies. We look at new proposals for the financial transactions tax.
I think they are more opposed to this tax than any other, because this tax really drives a stake into the heart of the current business model. You can see how that is very frightening for them.
But first, here's a quick roundup of the Tax Justice News headlines for this month. Good news! European Union rapporteurs have made some excellent proposals on the implementation of public country-by-country reporting for multinational companies. Now we hope the EU Commission will listen and take on board their recommendations. Not so good. EU finance ministers have come up with the final criteria for the identification of tax havens for their planned tax haven blacklist, supposed to be finalised by September 2017. It looks to us like the result will be pretty much an empty blacklist with all of the really important financial centres missing. Tax haven blacklists have always been farcical and politicised, but if they really wanted to do this properly, the work's already been done for them with the best objective ranking available. The Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. Romania's had its biggest protests since the fall of communism. Hundreds of thousands have braved sub-zero temperatures throughout this month over what they see as a decriminalisation of corruption committed by politicians and civil servants. The newly sworn-in government reformed an aspect of the penal code in secret. The Justice Minister's now resigned and that reform has been revoked, but protesters are still out there calling for the entire cabinet to step down. The EU Parliamentary Committee set up to investigate the Panama Papers scandal and propose reforms came to the heart of the beast, the City of London, this month on an investigative visit. The committee was due to meet Treasury officials, but they pulled out and didn't send any minister or even a senior civil servant. Also in the UK, the list of those who funded the political campaigning around Brexit is about to be published. It turns out that rather a lot of money, which funded expensive Leave adverts, was funnelled through a party in Northern Ireland, where political donations are kept secret. The Northern Irish Secretary is under pressure to make the details of this dark money public. And the best news of all this month will send shivers down the spines of those in corruption enabler professions around the world. Founders of the law firm at the heart of the Panama Papers scandal, Jürgen Mossack and Ramon Fonseca, have been arrested on money laundering charges linked to the funnelling of bribes to politicians and civil servants via offshore accounts from Brazilian construction company Odebrecht. The company admits to paying $800 million in bribes across Latin America. The real figure's probably much more. No bail's been granted to Mossack and Fonseca because they're considered a flight risk. One of their lawyers has also been arrested. Panamanians, meanwhile, have been out on the streets protesting against corrupt deals their own government may have been involved in with the firm. This Odebrecht scandal's engulfing the whole continent, seemingly with no government with completely clean hands. Also in Latin America this month, Ecuadorians voted in a referendum to ban politicians and civil servants from hiding their wealth offshore. It is symbolically important, although the reality of financial secrecy is unchanged and they're as safe, really, to continue as they ever were. Only a leak like the Panama Papers risks exposing them. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John, this month, one of Donald Trump's main priorities was to sign a law which rolls back anti-corruption regulation designed to combat what is basically revenue theft from the poor, really, in the poorest countries in the world, illicit financial flows coming out of those countries.
Yes, so President Trump chose Valentine's Day to sign off on his really first significant piece of legislation, which is a law that rolls back on a really important anti-corruption provision in the Dodd-Frank Act that requires companies in the extractive industries, that's oil and gas and the mining companies and such like, to disclose the payments they make to governments.
Remember that some of the oil companies in other countries are legally bound to disclose their payments to governments in 30 other countries. So this does give companies like ExxonMobil a foot up in the race, and they've long complained that this pesky regulation put them at a competitive disadvantage when they're making deals, when they're up against state-owned companies from Russia and China.
No matter how hard I try to understand why the president wants to get rid of one of the most important anti-corruption measures of the past decade, I can't see this as anything other than a huge gift to big oil and a huge gift to corrupt kleptocrats and to their business cronies more generally. Some people have tried to spin this measure as an attempt to make the United States firms more competitive, to make United States oil companies more competitive. And while it's true that the US did lead the way in strengthening disclosure requirements by multinational companies, the vast majority of major oil companies and mining companies around the world now have to comply with similar transparency measures in other countries. So this step by President Trump is nothing other than a major step backwards. And as one US senator has described it, this is a Valentine's gift to kleptocrats and corrupt businesses in the United States and around the world.
Yeah, and I should mention that the Secretary of State for Trump is Rex Tillerson, who was chairman and chief executive of ExxonMobil.
And, of course, has had a lot of experience in negotiation with Russian businesses and with the Russian government. And, of course, they'll be only too pleased that transparency provisions like this are removed because, let's face it, so much of what happens around Russian oil and gas happens in complete secrecy.
The European Union Commission has made a statement saying it hasn't got any plans to join this race to the bottom by re-regulating over their transparency rules. And a lot of the oil companies would say, well, not to worry because the US Foreign Corrupt Practices Act is still in place. But that's a very inadequate piece of legislation, isn't it? Doesn't cover half of what needs to be covered.
And that is the problem, of course, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. It's so targeted at bribery, and this is not the same as bribery. There are a whole host of other factors involved here, including tax evasion and similar. This has opened the field for a much wider variety of corrupt practices. And one can well imagine the oil lobbies will now start concentrating on the European Union, and they'll be saying we have to compete in this race to the bottom with the United States companies, otherwise we'll be at a competitive disadvantage. And that raises questions. What is that competitive disadvantage? Well, it's a competitive disadvantage which stops us from acting as criminals.
Nice. Let's talk about Switzerland now, because it's nice to have some good news, isn't it? Because the Swiss have had one of their famous referendums on reforming corporate taxation, and these reforms were roundly rejected by 59% of voters, who felt that these proposals were far too generous to companies at their expense. That's the expense of ordinary taxpayers. So they basically refused to pick up the tab, which is pretty good news. And it says a lot about the kind of shift in business models that's going on by nation states towards race to the bottom on corporate taxation, trying to beat each other down to zero and probably beyond that.
Yeah, well, three cheers for the Swiss public. Well done. It is very good news indeed. And I think it reflects a general shift in attitudes in Switzerland. This referendum represents a very major defeat for the Swiss federal government and for the business and tax haven lobbyists in Switzerland who've been pushing forward with corporate tax reforms, which in many respects were highly regressive, and I think the public recognised that. The background to this referendum lies with a rather sneaky attempt by the federal government to present what was clearly a regressive corporate tax reform as a progressive reform intended to abolish some kinds of special treatments for some companies. So they were dressing it up as a move forward, whereas in fact it was pushing for along this race to the bottom to reduce or remove taxes on capital in the nonsensical language of making the Swiss corporate tax regime more competitive internationally. My friend and former colleague, Bruno Gertner, who was chair of Tax Justice Network's global board for many years, he tells us that the Swiss government was confident of pushing these reforms through almost without any public kickback. So when civil society pushed for a referendum and managed to explain to the Swiss public that these reform proposals would mean either higher taxes for the majority of people, though not for the rich, or cuts in public services, or both, the direction of the wind changed entirely and the government lost the referendum. I think this is a great win for tax justice and a win for civil society activism.
Put Switzerland in an interesting position now, doesn't it? Because they were supposed to have reformed their tax system by 2019 to supposedly avoid being put on blacklists of tax havens. And now the finance minister says because of this vote, they won't be able to meet that 2019 deadline. Remains to be seen whether Switzerland actually ever would get put on a tax haven blacklist. And, you know, the OECD head has even made some reassuring noises to say that there was no blacklist being prepared against Switzerland. But where does it leave them?
Well, let's face it, Switzerland, of course, tops the Tax Justice Network Financial Secrecy Index. They rank number one on the index because they are such a big player and have such a long-term commitment to secrecy and lack of information exchange. So they are at the top of what I think is the best ranking available here. But they are now in a real quandary because this proposal comes from global measures to remove what are called ring-fenced arrangements, where they make special provision for companies which trade outside Switzerland but operate through Switzerland and book their profits through Switzerland, and they're separate from the normal Swiss companies. This kind of ring-fencing is now being closed down on, and that was what the Swiss government was pretending they were doing. But in bringing forward the proposals, they hid the other intention, which was to introduce new tax haven measures like the patent box facility to help more companies avoid tax in Switzerland. That's now been rejected. So they're going to have to go back to square one and think through what provisions will be acceptable in a time when I think the majority of Swiss people no longer want Switzerland to be labelled a tax haven. So they're going to have to really rethink their development model entirely.
OK, let's talk about dark money and the results of the Transparify survey, which assesses organisations and think tanks in the United Kingdom in terms of transparency levels, although this could be just as relevant in any country in the world. Tax Justice Network, I'm glad to say, got full marks for transparency. In this report, they name seven dark money groups, as they call them, who are spending £22 million influencing UK politics. They name a number of organisations, and many of them which are all about economics and influencing the debate on economics, like the Institute of Economic Affairs and the Adam Smith Institute, all ranked highly opaque. You know, many of these think tanks are all over the media without so much as a disclaimer about the fact that there are basically undeclared interests behind them. No wonder, really, that the debate on economics and tax is so very skewed, and the BBC is number one in the firing line for not being sharper in terms of cracking down on this stuff and being journalistically more accurate in the way these organisations are portrayed.
Yeah, but I think it's quite right that the BBC is put in the firing line on this one because they have very poor track record here. Democracy really relies on public trust, not just in the politicians who take the decisions on our behalf, but also trust in the journalists who inform us and in the researchers who prepare the detailed reports which shape public debates. Many of these researchers are employed by think tanks and equivalent organisations, which includes the Tax Justice Network. And we've known for many years that many think tanks, including prominent organisations, and let's name them, the Institute of Economic Affairs is one, Policy Exchange, the Adam Smith Institute, these organisations receive considerable news coverage internationally, not least on the BBC. But they are not open and they're not honest about who funds them. And that matters. Now, thanks to the occasional leak or court disclosure, we found out that some of the funding sources come from big business lobbies, this including tobacco and big oil. But this is not made clear, and the BBC provides airtime to these organisations whilst pretending that they are independent think tanks without conflicts of interest, which is not the case. So this new report from Transparify is hugely important. The public must be able to trust the integrity of researchers, and this requires that researchers reveal all of their funding sources and any possible conflicts of interest. Tax Justice Network, we've always given this really high priority, and we should expect all other think tanks to do exactly the same. The least we can expect in the light of the 2017 report from Transparify is that the BBC immediately stops giving any airtime to any think tank that fails this basic transparency test.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. So many economies in the so-called developed world are stagnating, and many of us are asking why that is and what we can do about it. Well, the evidence is stacking up against some of the major culprits, the often oversized, reckless finance sectors of these countries are actually dragging us down. They're overcharging us and they're undertaxed. So this month, we look at the role of financial transaction taxes in bringing back stability to our financial systems and helping our economies grow in healthier and more sustainable ways. Financial transaction taxes aren't new. In fact, one of Britain's oldest taxes is a 0.5% stamp duty or tax when you buy shares issued by UK companies. That was introduced in 1694, well over 300 years ago, and it still raises over £3 billion a year. It's one of the cheapest taxes to collect and the hardest to evade. And things have changed a lot in banking and finance since then, but the way we tax the sector today just hasn't caught up with 21st century realities. And the fact that our financial sectors aren't exactly the engines of growth they claim to be.
Imagine that you and I were a bank. If we make more money by our trading operations and trading and working with high frequency traders, then that's what we're going to do.
This is economist Professor Avinash Persaud. He was voted one of the top three public intellectuals in the world on the financial crisis. He says one of the problems is that banks make more money from what he calls churning than from investing in the longer term.
I remember when I was a banker, the largest pension fund in the world, CalPERS, you know, was over $300 billion in those days. But they generated as much commissions to the banks as a relatively small hedge fund, because the small hedge fund turned over their portfolio so much more rapidly. CalPERS turned over its entire portfolio, so, you know, buying and selling its entire portfolio once every 2.5 to 3 years. But a hedge fund might do that once every 2 to 3 months. And so we earn a lot more commission from the hedge funds. And as a result, our research was geared towards helping the hedge funds, because the more our research, our support, our trading operations focused on those people, the more commissions we would get. So we were very uninterested in providing long-term research for long-term pension funds, because they didn't provide the commissions to the bank. And so the banking system then becomes focused on servicing, providing information for the short-term players, then the long-term investment gets neglected. So if, you know, something that's socially optimum, investing in the long-term, is being crowded out by things that are socially less optimum, very short-term trading, then you would impose a tax to try and redress the balance.
Right, and you make the point that short-term trading isn't bad in of itself, but it's a question of proportion.
Right. So an efficient economic system needs a bit of trading, needs a bit of speculation. It's about the proportion. A couple of decades ago, something like 10% of the stock exchange would have been short-term trading, and that was probably a reasonable proportion. Today, it's about 60%. So, you know, 60% of our efforts, of our focus, of our turnover is on the very short-term stuff. And that's excessive, it's disproportionate, and it's crowded out long-term investing. And the only way one grows an economy is by investing, you know, in infrastructure and in the long term. And it's no surprise then that as high-frequency trading has increased, the amount of investing going on in some of the developed economies has been falling. And now we're seeing that in the growth rates of these countries, which are really puttering to a, you know, very modest 1% to 2%. And the only way to lift that growth rate is by investing. And of course, low growth low opportunities, rising unemployment or underemployment. All of that has contributed to some of the political challenges we're having today, be it Brexit, be it Trump, be it anti-immigrant feelings, etc., etc.
And even the once relatively simple process of lending money has become another opportunity for more of this churning that you're talking about.
Well, the financial industry has gone through a dramatic change in its model. In the old days, banks lent money and they held the loan on their balance sheet. Today, banks initiate the loan, originate the loan. Then they may package them together, they may securitize them, they may trade them. They then have another division that will invest in them. And so this loan now circulates around the economy. And the argument was that doing it that way allows for banks to be able to lend more, be able to do so more cheaply because they're not taking up their balance sheet. That allows them better risk management. And so all these things were in the interests of the financial system, were in the interests of consumers. It would be less risky and cheaper lending.
But as the financial crisis showed us, it wasn't less risky, and cheaper it most certainly was not. In a recent report called Overcharged, The High Cost of High Finance, Professor Gerald Epstein says the US financial system will impose an excess cost on that nation of up to $22.7 trillion, and he's basing that on the period between 1990 and 2023. According to him, that means finance, in its current form, is a net drag on the US economy. There's research at the moment going on into the claims the City of London makes about its contribution to Britain's economy. The financial crisis alone cost the UK about £3.4 trillion. That's 166% of its GDP. And it gets worse. The advantages of digitalisation, computerisation over the last 30 years have been great for the finance sector, but the benefits haven't been passed on to consumers at all, according to a professor of finance at New York University. Here's Professor Passord on his work.
Some very fascinating work by Thomas Philippon. He actually looked at what was the total cost of raising finance for someone outside the financial sector. So the cost of the non-financial sector raising money from the financial sector. And he found that this number was just shy of 2%. So if you have a loan of $1 million, 2% of that loan is tied up in the fees and charges. And in these days, it's not one charge or fee, it's multiple charges and fees. And he found that if you were to add up all these new charges and fees, it's about 2%. And in fact, he goes back in time tracking this, and he finds it's about 2% back in 1880, that in the period of greatest regulation in the 1940s, 1950s, 1970s, this number dips lower. It's about 1.5% at one point. But then after the 1980s and the great liberalization of the 1980s, when we thought this was in order to make things cheaper for consumers, it was certainly done in the name of consumers, this number began rising again. So today, we've got this amazing system where no one really holds anything. Everyone is shuffling it around. It's supposed to make things cheaper, but actually it hasn't made things cheaper. It is just as expensive for someone to take out a loan today, raise money on the equity markets, raise money in the bond markets, than it was in 1880, the age of steam, before computers, electricity, etc.
So, to address these things in the UK, Professor Passord's proposing much-needed modernisation of the 322-year-old 0.1% UK financial transactions tax on shares by getting rid of loopholes currently used and abused by hedge funds and extending the tax to derivatives. He says that should raise an extra £5 billion a year for the UK. That's well over $6 billion. And the advances in computerisation and the progress in transparency do now provide a great opportunity for most countries to take matters into their own hands. Many already have. Here's David Hillman of the Robin Hood Tax Campaign.
With markets being almost 100% automated, this means the tax is extremely inexpensive and relatively easy to collect, and it's actually extremely difficult to avoid.
Right, and lots of countries have already got different kinds of financial transactions taxes in place, or FTTs for short, because they're free to act unilaterally, they don't need international agreements.
Over the last few decades, more than 40 countries, either permanently or temporarily, have implemented FTTs. And every single country has done that unilaterally. The UK has a 0.5% tax on shares. America has a very, very tiny FTT. It raises $1 billion a year, pays for the Securities and Exchange Commission. In the last few years, France has implemented a small tax on shares. It was at 0.2%. It's just about to move to 0.3%. It will then move from raising around a bit under $1 billion to raising about €1.5 billion a year. Italy also recently introduced a tax. The general overview from bodies that have assessed the impact is that it has raised money with no great negative impact to their financial industries. Most countries like India, Hong Kong, South Africa, they all have FTTs. They're kind of part of the furniture, and they've been raising money alongside income tax, VAT, corporation tax, for many a long year.
Professor Persaud, there's been particularly strong opposition to extending the existing financial transaction tax from the City of London in the UK, and all finance sectors do seem to fight the idea of financial transaction taxes tooth and nail. Why do they hate it so much, in your opinion? I mean, it's such a tiny tax.
Well, I think they are more opposed to this tax than any other, because this tax really drives a stake into the heart of the current business model. The current business model is we don't own stuff, we trade stuff. So if you're presenting a tax based on how often you trade, this is the only tax that really attacks that model and would force them to go back to an older model where what mattered is longer term commitments. There are many good reasons why we should go back to that model. But you could see how that is very frightening for them, because their entire business model is based around frequent transactions.
And they know there's no clever way of getting around the financial transaction tax that's been in place for so long in the UK, right? The one you're proposing to extend.
Britain has had this tax for 322 years. They've had 322 years to consider innovative ways of avoiding this tax, using all the technology and other ways, and they've not been able to do so. Yes, they do talk about relocation.
Right, and threatening to relocate won't do them any good at all, because your proposals for extending this financial transaction tax are based on the owner, not on the location where the transaction to be taxed takes place.
Yes, if you were an American buying a UK share, you would be taxed, and whether you bought that share anywhere in the world, you would still be taxed. So there's no point you moving your trading position. If you're a British person buying a French share, the extensions we're proposing is you would be taxed in buying that share. And we have beneficial ownership information on who owns those shares being traded. And so that's how we can extend this tax, using some of the recent mutual information agreements in a way that we couldn't do before.
At the moment, 10 countries in the European Union are negotiating the implementation of a European financial transaction tax by 2017. Their idea is a 0.1% tax on the value of the buying and selling of all securities like shares and bonds. That excludes sovereign bonds, though. And a 0.01% tax on derivatives. David Hillman.
The way in which it's envisaged is it'll probably be in two phases. The first phase, I believe, will bring in around 15 billion euros a year, and the second phase will bring in 22 billion plus. So it's a significant amount of money. The money will go to the countries themselves. It's not going to pay for the EU budget. And clearly, the amount of money that is raised depends mainly on how large the respective financial markets are in the different participating countries. For the regional FTT, we're talking about 10 EU member states, which include Germany, France, Italy and Spain, obviously four very major states, and they comprise around 80% of Eurozone GDP.
And you could argue anyway that any kind of trading that can't survive a 0.01% tax, like the one the European Union countries are proposing for derivatives, probably shouldn't be happening in the first place.
Well, I mean, one could definitely argue that if a business is so worried about a 0.01% tax to their ability to survive, they probably shouldn't be in business in the first place. I mean, I think the financial crisis was clearly a massive wake-up call, and it was clear that there was no proper oversight on derivatives trading, and that the exponential increase in derivatives trading was clearly a fundamental contributor to the collapse. So there have been many moves to increase transparency in these areas, and this has definitely made it easier to tax derivatives. And that's because with derivatives, you need to tax those who trade derivatives rather than where the asset is issued. So you're taxing who is trading, and therefore greater information and oversight and need to declare for these actors clearly helps to ensure that you can bring in the revenues.
Ironically, for the tax justice movement, we'll know we've got a really effective set of financial transaction taxes if we see those revenues decline over time, because that should mean finance sectors are avoiding the potentially harmful economic activity we want them to, and they'd be doing less of this socially useless churning. Professor Avinash Persaud again.
I would encourage individual countries to adopt the tax. I think trying to have grand international agreements is difficult. The grander they are, the more difficult it is. I think the thing to do is to encourage individual countries to be bold enough to do it. Now, the challenge is that their financial sectors complain to them and say, you know, the sky will fall upon your head if you do it. And they don't tend to have enough confidence to say, I want to try it. So I think the more people can see that this tax works, it collects money, and it makes our system more stable, more robust, the more people will do it.
That's it for this month. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. Professor Persaud's report is called Improving Resilience, Increasing Revenue, the Case for Modernising the UK's Stamp Duty on Shares. And the other report I mentioned on Professor Gerald Epstein's estimates on the cost of the US finance sector is in a report called Overcharged, The High Cost of High Finance. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.